right. Once again, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. And damn, man, I'm just going to talk real fast because we got so much coming at you today that I don't want to spend any extra time. I'm already doing it by explaining myself, so I'll stop here at the back end of the show. We're going to be talking with playwright Bianca Bagatori, and Bianca's been a guest on the show a number of times. She's a close friend. She's also the author of a new play about Howard Zinn, okay? It's called The Time of Our Lies, about the life and times of historian Howard Zinn. So we'll be talking with Bianca at the back end of the show. In the middle of the show, we got a real treat. We're going to be joined by Wayne Kramer, guitarist and composer, and we're going to be talking about his new album. Get ready for this. It's called Lexington, and it's with his band, the Lexington Arts Ensemble, and it's a free jazz album, and it features this extraordinary ensemble of musicians and just an extraordinary album. So we're going to talk to Wayne about that. Opening the show up, I'm really, really pleased to have in studio with me now a person that, you know, I have to tell you, you know, I didn't know your work until last week. And then everybody kept coming up to me saying, you got to talk to this guy. And I said, who? They said, the guy with the really big afro. And I said, okay, why? And then I started looking at your work. And I thought, I got to have him on the show. And his name is Jody Armour. He's the Roy P. Crocker Professor of Law at USC's Law School. And he's an author. And his newest book is called Nigger Theory. And this man is just like, he's like a walking electric wire, okay, in terms of what he sets off here. So I want to jump right into this. Jody Armour, welcome to the show.
Great to be with you, Michael.
Yeah, well, let's talk about this. As I said, you deal with a lot. You deal with the question of the reality that faces black youth and black people in general, the reality that faces them every day of their lives. It's like, an entire people is living a sort of parallel existence, although it's right in the middle of this society that everybody talks about. It's post-racial, it's this, it's that. Yeah. And you're talking about, you come up with something where your work focuses on, hey, the reality is very different. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, the cataclysm, Michael, you know, over the last 30 years, we've seen with the crack plague and its festering aftermath, the mass incarceration of black youth in some inner city neighborhoods. Now, I just put this in my book from my textbook, my criminal law textbook, 90% of the young black men in some of these inner city neighborhoods will wind up in jail, on probation, or on parole at some point in their lives, 90%. And so the reason I started this work and called it Nigger Theory is that part of that mass incarceration problems stems from black leadership failure, as well as white American and general America's indifference to the plight of these young black males. And the N-word part comes from a skit done by Chris Rock, famous, launched his career, in which he says, his punchline is, I love black people, but I hate niggas. And one of his core definitions, key criterion of a nigga for him is a black person who's done a crime. So what he's saying, according to his logic and that distinction, 90% of the young black males in some of these inner city neighborhoods are going to wind up in jail, on probation, on parole at some point in their lives are niggas. And I cannot abide by a moral universe that divides between us and them, good and bad, in that way, and is going to condemn 90% of guys who are like my sons to niggerdom. And so that is why I'm coming in using the language as part of the N-word, as part of an oppositional discourse, just like Mark Twain did, just like Harriet Beecher Stowe and Uncle Tom's Cabin, just like Richard Pryor, Dave Chappelle, Pac, Nas, Big, a lot of the gangs of Ice Cube have used the N-word as part of an oppositional discourse to take on the status quo, the prevailing vocabulary, that kind of the calcified vocabulary and language of the academy, for example, that talks about mass incarcerations in very sterile, antiseptic terms, and you don't feel the pain of being in a 6x8 cell for 22 and a half hours a day in solitary and then 90 minutes in a windowless pen. That pain that many of these young black males are suffering because of the mass incarceration that followed on the crack plague and its festering aftermath, and that the black community helped to create, black leaders helped put them there. 1986 Anti-Drug Abuse Act, that was Charlie Rangel standing there right by Reagan when he signed it into law that created the 100-to-1 crack to powder disparity and required mandatory minimums for the first time in federal law since 72. So we had a lot of benighted black leadership as well as general American indifference and a way of thinking about black criminals that says they're niggas and we are black people. We're good Negroes. They are bad Negroes. That has led us now to this calamity that we got to get our minds around, hands around, and we're just starting to acknowledge in the last couple of years.
Tell me this, though, Jody, you know, because one of the things that I kept thinking about, and I know I've heard some of your interviews and stuff on different TV stations and whatnot, you know, and I've read some things, and I kept thinking about this. I think your point is really, really important. But I also think, you know, like, here's something, let me put it this way. Let's jump into this first, because this is the big hair sitting in the room, okay?
Right on.
Let's talk about this, because I want to know, you know, you went further than that, because, and it has something to do with where is this coming from, what's behind
yes.
it. You grew your hair out into a natural. A really magnificent fro, okay? Why'd you do that, and what impact has it had on you, and what did you learn from this?
Oh, it's had a huge impact on me. I started all this work because my dad was incarcerated for 22 to 55 on some trumped-up possession and sale of marijuana charges, and I started thinking seriously about the plight of poor black males who are disproportionately incarcerated. I started writing this book, Nigga Theory, and I missed a couple trips to Hair Architects, my local barbershop. I missed several months of trips. And then I went back to school, started teaching, overheard some of my students comment that it's ironic that the language they use, that Professor Armour teaches criminal law while he looks like a criminal. And I said, whoa, wait, the only difference between me before when I looked like Obama and me now is nappy hair. When I let the naps flow, suddenly I look like a criminal. And I even saw this same experience replicated at J.W. Marriott down at L.A. Live. I'm waiting for my friend Lino, my roommate from Lower Merion High School. You say you're from Philly, right outside Philly, you know, on the main line. And we get back together again. He's ESPN Deportes general manager, and I'm waiting in the lobby. Getting ready to go home, and three guards approach me, and this is just a couple months ago now. I am 50-something with gray hair. They approach me. They send the black one over to me. The black one says, sir, are you here to see someone? I said, yes, I was, but why aren't you asking anyone else in the lobby? It was around 11:30. He said, well, we've been having a problem with transients. I said, I look like a transient. Now, I had on exactly like I'm dressed now, except a tie. I had on slacks, hard shoes, a button-up shirt. I said, I look like a transient. He said, don't take it personally. Walked away. I tweeted real quick, called a former student at Latham Downtown Firm so someone else can hear this if they came back. He came back over and said, sir, what is the name of the guest you came here to see? Now, I teach torts in criminal law. I've taught him long enough to know this. What he was saying was, if I don't give him a name that they can find in the database, I've assumed the ejectable status of a trespasser, and they're going to lift me up bodily and throw me out of that lobby. That's what he was telling me just 2 months ago. Okay, a law professor who has a chair at USC. So because of the fro, when I look like Obama, I didn't get this. So this fro is my hoodie. I say my afro is my hoodie. You know, when there's hoodies up, my afro is my hoodie. I wear my heart on my head, not my sleeve, as I say, and I'm happy to be nappy, and I'm going to continue being nappy and repping for folks who want to celebrate the African-American soul through their nappiness and not be discriminated against and profiled in the process.
I like what you said, too, though. You said the more radical your politics got, the bigger your fro got.
That's right. No, Michael, it was just like as my thesis that I was writing in the book grew more radical, my hair grew more nappy. And they intertwined at some point, and like nappy ivy climbing a red brick wall, they intertwined, and here we are.
All right. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Jody Armour. Jody's a professor of law at the University of Southern California. So, Jody, that says something to me about what's behind all this. You know, if you think about what's going on with mass incarceration, what happened with the war on drugs, you know, that whole thing, I can't remember whether it was Ehrlichman or Haldeman talking to Nixon, and Nixon saying, look, here's the thing. We've got to solve this problem of the blacks. Yeah. Only we have to do it in a way that it doesn't look like that's what we're doing.
Yeah.
And so they invent this whole thing around the drug, you know, and they did start pushing drugs out in the community, but they invented this whole thing that was the war on drugs that really became a war not just on poor people, but very, very much focused up on black people. You know, and you think about that, there's a whole entire system that through this has gotten to a point now where you can't look at this without saying, look, if you look at what's been going on, the demonization, the isolation, the fact that people, when they come out of jail, their lives are pretty much over in terms of mainstream society for the most part.
Yep.
The thing is there's a whole system that seems to be pushing this, and there's a whole trend towards what I think is a slow genocide. What do you think of this?
Absolutely. And I think, Michael, I agree with much of what you said. I would just add a few extra nuances. One, it wasn't just the power structure that came up with the crack plague and its festering aftermath. Like I said, you had Charlie Rangel. Over half the Congressional Black Caucus voted for the 1986 Anti-Drug Abuse Act, okay, with 100-to-1 powder, cocaine, and mandatory minimums, like I said. So, and that Chris Rock line, he said that to a black audience who was rolling in the aisles when he said, I hate niggas, I love black people, and black criminals are niggas, all right? So we have, it's a deeper problem. It goes to how we think about morality, how we think about criminality, how we think about the good and the bad and the ugly, haves and have-nots, because it just so happens. See, what Chris Rock didn't say, and these other people who are demonizing criminals don't say, it just so happens that the vast majority of the people he's calling niggas are also from below the poverty line. It's not the middle class crime rate for blacks and the middle class crime rate for whites is almost identical. So the prisons are bulging from those truly disadvantaged blacks. And so what he's saying is, I love Bill Cosby blacks, but I hate truly disadvantaged blacks. That's a way to translate what he's saying. And that's the ugly class bigotry behind all of this politics of distinction.
Mm-hmm. One thing I'd have to say, too, though, is that, you know, look, even with this Charlie Rangel and the Black Congressional Caucus and all this stuff, I mean, no matter who's in there, I mean, Dellums, all these people were, you know, they were all part of this at that time. And the thing that you have to recognize is that throughout history, there have always been people who supposedly have some connection to the oppressed who've always stood up with and walked with the oppressor, who've always served. I mean, look, there was the Judenrat in Nazi Germany, you know, and in Poland. There was the people who sort of... Don't worry about this, you know, or we have to, we, damn it, it's personal responsibility and choices. You've got to just take responsibility for your life. And who eased the way into the camps. When we're talking about Germany, there were black slave owners, you know, in the South. You know, there was all these people who always had some aspect of relationship with the system and in terms of enforcing that oppression, you know, helping to make it go down. And that's why I keep thinking this thing about, look, the systemic question here, because even, I don't know, I just think it's really important, because when you're talking about Bill Cosby, I mean, look, that's his whole thing, is from the way people name their kids to wearing their pants, as if naming your kid Harry or something is going to make a difference, or wearing your pants tied up around your chest is going to make a difference in whether or not you can get a job, whether or not you stay out of jail. You know, this is a terrible situation that we're in, and people don't recognize that.
Yeah, and you put your finger right on the basic split. The basic split is between those people who explain poverty and crime and lots of other social issues in terms of personal deficiencies and personal responsibilities, and those who explain those same phenomena in terms of macro level social factors. Okay, that's the big split. And typically, those on the right are trying to explain things in terms of personal responsibility, and those who are more progressive are trying to say society needs to step up and take accountability for these social ills, for these social pathologies that these are merely symptoms of. So, yeah, that is the big battle that we're doing. But we got to recognize that many of the soldiers that we need fighting for a kind of more progressive agenda have bought into the personal responsibility line. President Obama, for example, he stands up in front of Morehouse men at graduation and starts lecturing them about personal responsibility. Okay, these guys who've just gone through 4 years of a grueling education and demonstrated abundant personal responsibility, he doesn't talk to students at Ohio State about personal responsibility. He doesn't talk to them at the other schools. But every time he's talking to black folks, it's about personal responsibility.
Well, look at what he did when he did that speech around the March on Washington, you know, and the whole point where he blamed black people for the situation that they're in today. You know, you're not doing the right thing. You're not taking personal responsibility. You're doing this, or you looked at, you turned those programs we had to give you aid. You turned it into a way to get a free welfare check or to get some freeload off of the system. And you're talking to a whole people that has been systematically oppressed that the foundation of this country was slavery, and it continues to this day. If you want to take a through line, you take Dred Scott, Emmett Till, and Trayvon Martin, and we can go on and on after that. But there's a through line there about what this country is, and it wouldn't be what it is today without that foundation of slavery.
Exactly, and we have to take on those personal responsibility folks frontally, you know, like
Obama. Here's a question, because how do you see doing that? You know, because look, there is a point that people raise, and I know they raise this to you about, well, look, Jody, you know, there are bad things going on in the ghetto. There are bad things going on between people. And you have those people who are just like buying into the thing and who are, you know, not, I'm not talking about the politicians and whatnot, but I'm talking about other people who look and say, well, you know, there's some stuff going on, whether they're white people, black people, whatever. There's some stuff going on there, and these, there are some crimes being committed here. And then there's the reality of there are crimes. There is, people treat each other badly in those kinds of situations a lot of times. How do you see changing the perception of all this, the thinking of all this, broadly in society, as well as among the people who are who are falling into this game.
Yeah, it should sadden but not surprise us. You take a group of people, you disproportionately concentrate them in desperate circumstances, they're going to disproportionately turn to desperate undertakings like crime. So, yes, there's crime going on among very poor people in these very truly disadvantaged areas. But the way you take on somebody like Obama, all these personal responsibility folks, is first you say, you know, walk the walk as well as talk the talk. Obama, you're talking about personal responsibility and how it's internal deficiencies that are holding black people back, a lack of a dad in the house, for example. You're always talking about how important it is to have a two-parent, how you only came from your single mom household. Well, hold on, time out. You only had one parent in the household and you wound up president? So apparently having only one parent in the household can't hold you back from being president, number one. Number two, the reason one parent in the household didn't hold you back is because you went to the best private high school in Honolulu, from which you went to Columbia and then on to Harvard, and you had grandparents that were able to put you in the best private high school in Honolulu. So you had economic support. So it had nothing to do with your internal deficiencies. It was what was your external support structures that helped you do what you did.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Jody Armour. Jody's a professor of law at the University of Southern California. Now, Jody, here's a point. I mean, yeah, you got all these external support structures, everything else, but there's a fundamental thing here. It is true. I mean, like, if you look at Obama, if Obama wasn't recognizable, and we saw it with Henry Louis Gates, you walk into your house, you could be beat up, pushed around, and arrested. You know, one of the foremost black intellectuals in the country, and the cat ends up in jail trying to explain why he's in his own house. You know, you can see these kinds of things that happen all the time, because there is this point of, and I'm more concerned. I'm not concerned about changing Obama's mind around this, because he, as far as I'm concerned, look, you can't be the commander in chief of this horrendous, person-eating, immoral, terrible, fascistic regime and somehow really be secretly, I'm on the side of the people. No, sorry, it doesn't work. And I'm not going to try and convince you to be on the side of the people. But there are a lot of other people that we have to talk about. How are you going to break them out of this stuff? You know, how are you going to break them? You know, because it's really a situation where really we are faced with a state of emergency, and there is not the commensurate response to that. You know, we have a state of emergency around what really is a slow genocide that could turn into a fast genocide.
Yes. We don't have a lot of concern for him, Michael, because we don't think for 30 years. I've been out here. I wrote that for my first book, Negrophobia, in 97. I was screaming about this issue. Nobody wanted to hear about it. People have jumped on the bandwagon the last year or two since Michelle Alexander wrote her book, The New Jim Crow, describing mass incarceration as a new form of Jim Crow. But here's why people haven't been upset about this for 30 years, because they don't see the victims of mass incarceration as anything like the victims of Jim Crow. The victims of Jim Crow, they saw as innocent blacks. You saw Medgar and Rosa and Martin. You don't see Stanley Tukey Williams and gangbangers and drug dealers as innocent victims of social oppression like Jim Crow. So you need to go after the moral argument. You need to go after the moral distinction. You need to have to go after what Chris Rock is trying to do when he drives a wedge between law-abiding people and criminals by saying, I love black people and I hate niggas. That's the new frontier, Michael, for 2014 and going forward.
Mm-hmm. And you know, the other thing, and damn, this time went fast. We are going to have you back, man, because we got to continue this conversation. Because the other thing is actually what we're getting up to is there has to be, look, I'm a revolutionary. I'm a communist. I believe that only revolution is going to resolve this situation. When you have a whole system that's based on the oppression of black people from the days of slavery on. And when you're talking about all these people who, yes, they are not given an inch in terms of their lives and what it's all about. But there's this thing of we have to find a way to actually break through on all this and to change the thinking broadly, the fight against things like mass incarceration. But even more, I think a lot more people, for me personally, I think a lot more people got to understand, where is this coming from? You know, is it really systematic and systemic? And that's a big thing. That's a big thing. Maybe what we can do, if you can comment on that if you want, and maybe we can come back very soon and talk about that again. Maybe.
Well, let's pick it up again. I'll just throw this out real quick. Durkheim, in his great book, Suicide, said, I'm going to take one of the most personal acts someone can imagine, the decision to take your own life, to be or not to be, that seems like you're only wrestling with your own personal demons, and I'm going to show you how that's a social fact, how self-destruction is really about social conditions and social facts and macro-level social phenomena. So, yeah, it's got to go that deep.
All right, Jody Armour, I am definitely going to have you back. It may be after the fun drive that's coming up, but I'm going to have you back, and we'll continue this conversation because we do really got to get much deeper into it.
I look forward to it.
Sure. Thank you, man. Thank you very much for being here. All right, you've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and our guest today has been Dr. Jody Armour. He's the Roy P. Crocker Professor of Law at USC, author of Negrophobia and Reasonable Racism, Nigger Lover, Luck, Law, and Language, and the Social Construction of Niggas, and he is also, his latest work is Nigger Theory. And pay attention to this because this is one of the most essential questions, an important question we're all facing today. We're going to take a quick break and be right back with Wayne Kramer, so stay tuned. All right, welcome back. All right, we've gone from a real high energy discussion in the beginning to something that's going to be even higher now because my next guest, I've followed his music since I was a kid. I talked to him the first time he was on the show was with David Was, and they did this song about Pat Tillman.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, his name is Wayne Kramer. For those of you who don't know, he was part of the MC5, and he's been a musician composer for all those years since then. And I have to say, you know, I never cease to be surprised. One, by when I listen to your music from MC5, it just blows my mind. Also, you come out with this thing, the first thing in 14 years that you've done as a soul, not really soul, you got this kick-ass band in there, but you did this free jazz album. I got to ask you about the genesis of the album, but I also, you know, and I know that's a multi-leveled answer, you know, in a lot of ways. But I want to, you know, I'll just jump right in and ask you this. You said that it could be, this is part of this reason how you ended up doing this is this was kind of, could be the musical narrative of the second half of your life. And I want to tell people the name of the album first is Lexington. The band that he's got in there is just, listen, folks, this is an amazing band. Aside from Wayne, we'll name the others later, but it's called the Lexington Arts Ensemble. And tell people what the album is and what's the genesis of it and what the hell are you doing making a jazz album, man?
Well, I guess it's something that was in me that had to come out. Lexington is the name of a federal correctional institution in Kentucky that I served a prison term in the 1970s, and kind of buried those thoughts for a long time. About eight years ago, I was hired to score a documentary on the facility and the story of America's first attempt to deal with drug addiction as a social problem rather than a legal problem. And in the course of scoring the film, it, of course, dredged up all these feelings and memories. And the score I did, I wanted it to be a jazz score because all the great jazz artists of the 40s and 50s and 60s that used illegal drugs ended up coming through Lexington for the cure or the attempt of a cure. And then the more I thought about it in the middle of the process, I said, geez, I got all these great players together. I love this music. Maybe I could repurpose some of these themes and make an album and use that to leverage this conversation about hyper-incarceration in America. I've taken a more active role with the founding of Jail Guitar Doors, Billy Bragg and my wife Margaret, and today we're actually in over 50 American prisons with a waiting list of 60 more with our guitars and our music programs. So the music really is a way for me to try to tell the story of what it was like for me as a bright-eyed, bushy-tailed young rock and roll kid waking up one morning in a federal prison, and then what I experienced and what I felt and try to do it in the way that I speak the most eloquently, which is in music.
Well, I'm going to, you know, people should know that that first piece that we opened the segment up with was Chasing the Fire Engine, which is a sample, just a small sample of what's on the album. And we're going to listen to a couple more, but, you know, I still want to get into this thing, though. It's more than just knowing that all these jazz musicians went into Lexington. I mean, you know, and there were a lot of writers who went in there. I always think of Bill Burroughs. I mean, I, you know, took a class with Bill Burroughs and was friends with his son, and both of them were in there. They sort of had,
that's,
you know,
right.
They had legacy questions there.
Yes.
But there was, you know, part of the thing that went on in terms of this is you turned from what you were universally known as. You know, and it's not turned from. That's what I came to understand as I thought about this. It's actually, it was a sort of a blossoming of the relationship between, look, you were known as a kick-ass rock musician, right? That's what you were and are to a certain extent. You're a musician. I mean, that's what you think, you know? Yeah. But you took it into this jazz. And then I started to think, there's always been this connection between MC5, between you and jazz in some way. Can we talk about that a little?
Sure. When I was a younger man, probably around 17 years old, living in Detroit, you know, I started playing music early. Music comes easy for me. I could play the guitar. I could play Chuck Berry music, and I could play, you know, Beatles songs and Rolling Stone songs. But young people are always looking for their own voice. And I was trying to find myself. And when John Sinclair turned me on to the music of Albert Eiler and John Coltrane and Cecil Taylor, Sonny Murray and Pharoah Sanders and Archie Shepp, I heard what I was looking for. I heard the direction of the future. I heard musicians that I felt were just like me, except they were technically more proficient because they were highly accomplished jazz musicians and I was a rock guitar player. But still, I could hear them striving, seeking to get into something new, to get into a new sonic dimension, a more pure dimension. And I said, okay, now the way is clear for me. I would hear it in some rock music. I heard it in the music of Pete Townsend in his guitar playing, or Jeff Beck, that these guys were also pushing the guitar out. And that's where I wanted to be. I wanted to be out on the tip of the spear of this stuff. Mm-hmm. So this music, my love of free jazz and experimental music has been with me from the beginning. It was a huge component in the MC5.
Mm-hmm. We're going to talk about that in a minute. And I want to let people know that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show. And we're talking today with Wayne Kramer, guitarist, musician, composer, with a great new album called Lexington. And he's got it with this band that I'm telling you is a killer band. It's the Lexington Arts Ensemble. We're going to talk about the band in a minute. But I want to let people hear another little piece. Teddy, let's do track 3 on this, all right? Welcome back. And that was ARC from Wayne Kramer's new album. What is ARC, brother?
ARC stands for the Addiction Research Center, which was a part of the prison where they did experiments on prisoners with different drugs. For the drug companies, for example, they would test things out. The facility, Lexington, from inception was designed to be a place to do research And they did the research on drug addicts because drug addicts were the only people that actually knew about drugs. They yes. were the experts. And it's funny to me. I mean, I have a twisted sense of humor, but
anybody who's been there will find that funny. Okay, that's the point.
What the researchers did was, if you volunteered for an experiment, a research experiment, you could have either time off of your sentence or the drug of your choice, so that you could store them up. Nobody ever took time off their sentence.
Yeah, well, there's a certain kind of rehabilitation going on there. Okay.
Well, you had to reward people somehow.
Yeah, yeah. You ever hear that piece that Burroughs did around being in Lexington, and they kept coming up to him and they said, you know, soak the flag in heroin and I'll do anything you want me to do. I'll suck on it, need it if you want me to. This is the thing, though. With that cut, I felt, now again, this is just me in wildness here, but I don't think it's that wild, but there's this synergy between what you were just saying before we listened to it, between the music that you made as part of the MC5 and during that whole period, and the music that you wanted to make or you were feeling in terms of this, in terms of the jazz and the rock, and there's something new that came there because you're listening to that. You've got that groove that's common to both, but there's a combination there that just sort of takes it to a whole other level. I was really astounded by that.
Well, thank you. A lot of the credit goes to my partner on this project, Dr. Charles Moore, who Charles and I met in probably 1966 in Detroit. And, you know, we lived in the same neighborhood, went out with the same women, smoked the same marijuana, dealt with the Detroit Police Department, you know, had all this starved together, you know, love our music together. So we were always the same people, just he came from the jazz world and I came from the rock world. And we worked together in the 60s in the MC5. He did horn arrangements on MC5 records, and he would organize sections to play with the band on special concert occasions. So when we both ended up out here and I wanted to get to work on this score, he was the first guy I called. I said, Charles, here's a great opportunity for us to work together again.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's one thing, there's one person too, there's a couple people I want to talk about, but there's another person who, in terms of that through line between back then and now, you also have on there one of my favorite people and a great trombonist, Phil Ranelin.
Yes.
You know, now this is a cat, Indianapolis born, New York, but ends up in Detroit and he starts the Tribe. And he does some of the most radical, both musically in terms of form and sound, but also politically. He does some stuff. And I'm thinking that, one, did you work with Phil then? Did you know him? And how did you pull him into this?
I didn't know Phil in the Detroit days, but Charles brought Phil in on the project. And we had done a couple records together. We're around the same sessions. And, you know, Phil and his work in the Tribe, you know, we're all kind of part of the same fabric, you know, coming up through the world of Detroit music and our love of jazz. And so, yeah, Phil is a big part of what I'm doing today.
You know, it's funny because when I got this, then I sat down and I pulled out a couple of my albums from Phil and, you know, the vibe from the Tribe. And so and you look at even the liner notes. When you're reading the liner notes, there's something else that came out of this, too. And I think in a similar way with you. There's something else that comes out in terms of a general ethos that extends from and has grown but is rooted in a period where there was just like standing up against all the bull that's going on in society, standing up and saying, look, there's got to be a better world, and our music is expressing that. And that was something that really struck me a lot in this.
I've come to believe that art is our only defense against the corporate and state power on our bodies. You know, the state and the corporations impose themselves on us. And how else do we have to fight back except with our art?
Well, I could name a few things, but that's for another show. Okay. Well, seriously, it's true. Art is extremely important in terms of people's consciousness. Yeah. It really is. Helping people understand and see and begin to be able to imagine a different world.
I think it's the spark, you know. Of course, art does not replace a political organization and good old-fashioned, you know, committees and
getting
the vote out and protests and all that.
But that's all part of it, too. Yeah, and the main thing, though, is that it really plays a role in really sort of changing the way people look at the world to a certain extent.
I think so. I mean, if you see that cave painting of the guys chasing down the antelopes, you know his story that day.
Especially because he had an electric guitar across his back, right? Listen, I want to get people to have a chance to hear this one song that I talked to you a little bit earlier about.
But before we do, let me remind people once again that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we're talking today with Wayne Kramer, legendary guitarist and composer, and we're talking about his new album, Lexington.
So, Teddy, let's move into, what is it? That's the next
13th
track.
13th Hour.
Yeah, it's 13th Hour. It's track 4, Teddy. Lexington Arts Ensemble, Wayne Kramer, 13th Hour. Wayne, I'm telling you, man, having lived my own version of your life, I must have listened, and look, this will tell you how either neurotic or just obsessed I am. I listened to this thing about 50 times, not really, but maybe 10 times, because it captured something. There's something in there, one about Lexington, but also just about the whole scene, and it's just so beautiful, but it also has that thing I was telling you earlier. It has that cross, you know, you're sitting there thinking, God, this is like one of those things that has like a half a bottle of whiskey. You don't know whether it's half empty, half full, but you're sitting in a chair in a dark room. Or you're William Burroughs, Naked Lunch. I woke up because something was pulling on my right hand. It was my left hand. You know? This is sort of like, you know, this song is very powerful, but wow, what a mood. I mean, it's like amazing.
Well, thanks. Yeah, I think people talk about the 11th hour, you know. Well, you can past what happens after the 11th hour and you go into the 12th hour and then the 13th hour when you've passed that point of no return. And you know, in the life of people that abuse alcohol and drugs, in the lives of people that end up serving prison sentences, we all hit that pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, you know, that point of, God. And I just thought, you know, I had a musical idea there, and me and Charles worked on it, and the other element I think is Bernard Herrmann, who is, as a film composer, one of my great idols, and I was trying to make it Herrmann-esque in a way as well. So, mm-hmm. And the Cats played beautifully on it, mm-hmm. as they do on the whole album.
Yeah. I wish we had more time. We could talk about that piano player, man. Boy, that dude is.
Tigran Hamasyan is a superstar a piano player. He's already hugely popular in Europe, and he's destined to be a great star in jazz and in pop music too. He's mm-hmm. really unbelievable.
We're running up on our time, but I have one more question for you, and that is, when you talked about the way that meshing between rock, jazz, and what you found in common with all these cats that were like just really stretching the limits, really reaching out, really looking to go somewhere where none have gone before. You also talked about you're not a retro person, you don't like retro music,
right.
That you find the unknown much more exciting than the known.
Yeah.
And where is that going to take you now?
Well, it's hard to say because I'm discovering that there may be people out there that appreciate this. You know, young people have really surprised me in their open-mindedness to this way of playing music. And this music is not elitist, and it's not for, you know, smarty pantses. It's you just have to have an open mind and love music, because what we're doing is playing music. We're just not playing it according to the old rules. Mm-hmm. Everything that's true about music, harmony, melody, rhythm, is all on. It's all in place. And it's, in fact, harder to play without the rules than it is to play with the rules.
It's so much more fun.
Well, it is for me.
And I want to go on that trip with you, brother, so keep me informed, all right?
You know, now, I will.
When is the album dropping?
Comes out April 29th. Yeah.
Except for...
Day before my birthday.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
April 29th, the day before your birthday. Wow. Yeah. You know what else happened April 29th? The LA Rebellion.
Ah.
There you go.
Ah, so, love it.
Yeah. Wayne, you just can't get away from this stuff, man.
No.
Now, but tomorrow, there's going to be a special release?
Yes. I think it's the Record Store Day release. So it'll be available for download. And will the vinyl be available then? Vinyl will be available too. It's 1,000 copies of signed vinyl.
Okay, cool. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Wayne Kramer. And Wayne is just a remarkable musician. And together with the Lexington Arts Ensemble, he has put out an album that I think everybody's got to get hold of and listen to many times and spread it around. It's called Lexington, a really fantastic free jazz album, which is just amazing. I'm so glad you did this, Wayne. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Okay, take care now.
Bye-bye.
We're going to take a quick break and be right back, so stay tuned. We're going to be talking with Bianca Bagatorian, so stay tuned. Welcome back. I don't want to cut that short, but we're got to, all right? And particularly, this is History Crying for a Change, and it's by Fred Ho, who died last weekend. It fits our next segment, and I thought it's a nice way to think about Fred Ho. So History Crying for a Change. Joining us now is Bianca Bagatorian, playwright and filmmaker, and somebody who's been on the show a couple of times before.
That's right.
And who always brings quite a bit to it, and she's once again in the middle of what promises to be a really remarkable project. It's a play called The Time of Our Lies, and it's about the life and times of historian Howard Zinn. Now, before we start, Bianca, first I'll say welcome to the show. They got that. I want to play that one little piece of an interview with Howard that you did, all right?
Oh, sure.
So,
go right
Teddy,
ahead.
Can you go on and do that?
You want to try this out and see how this sounds?
Yeah, and then maybe you introduce yourself, if you could just say
this is Howard Zinn, sitting here in my living room with Bianca, and talking about very important things, history, life, war, peace. I've always felt that knowing history is a matter of life and death. By that I mean that if you don't know history, it's as if you were born yesterday. If you were born yesterday, then anybody in authority can say anything they want to you. Can tell you that, as the president will tell a nation, we must go to war for liberty, for democracy. Whatever you're told, you have no way of checking up on it if you don't know any history. If you know history, then you have a way of looking at what you have been told and looking at history and deciding if the history that you know authenticates, bears out, supports whatever you've been told. And if you find that that history does not bear it out, then you know you have been deceived.
All right, been deceived. Now, Bianca Bagatorian, that was you interviewing Howard Zinn. And for this play, tell us what the play is about.
Okay, I'm glad you played that because I was going to quote that piece. You know, I was very fortunate to have met a remarkable human being like Howard Zinn, and it's such a great loss that he's not with us anymore. I was really honored to do this. And I worked with him for about a period of a year through interviews, emails, read all his books and texts, and we talked a lot about many different things. And I kept asking him, what is the most important thing that you have achieved through all your work and all your years of experience? And he would always come back and say to me, to know your history, or you're a blank slate. So I think that's really great that you played that piece. And that's kind of what I tried to base the play around, was knowing your history, so that when people get up and say, go to war, you need to go to war, you know that, well, wow, we did this before, and what were the consequences, and why did we do it, so that you can question what you're being told. So the play centers around a more personal journey of Howard's. I remember I did a first draft of that, and when I was in my master's program at Brooklyn College with Mac Wellman, and he said, well, it's very factual, that's great, but I really want to see Howard take his pants down. So I went back and I examined this, and through talking to Howard, he would always, when you met Howard, the first thing he would say is, do you know that I bombed a village in Royan when I was 23? I killed people. He was very adamant about letting people know that that is where his journey began. And he was a bombardier at 23, and he said the war was almost over, and one morning they woke him up, and they went, and they used jellied petroleum, which was napalm, and they killed loads of civilians. And he didn't find this out later until he had met some people from this village that he bombed, and they said there was a lot of bodies of civilians in the streets. So he was very adamant that people know that he had actually had this experience himself. So through the play, it's a multimedia play, and it uses puppets and dance and rap, and I made loads of songs using Howard's words, and I quote him all the time. They're his words. They're not mine. I'm no historian. But we follow this journey of him, and he talks to other soldiers, as I did. I went out and interviewed lots of soldiers from Afghanistan and just tried to sort of look at their jaded eyes, their glazed over expressions, and just it felt so horrible to see these young boys go out and come back, and they're just changed for life, fighting for intentions that are very unclear.
The one thing, though, when you think about it, too, the thing with Howard, when he was changed for life, he actually took it in a direction to really expose the lies that had been told to justify what he did as a soldier, you know, and that's something that we really need much more of. And I really am excited about what your play is doing. And I know your work, where you've concentrated a lot around the Armenian genocide. You've also in Rwanda, you've been doing a tremendous amount around that. And I was reading about how you're staging this play and all the different aspects that are involved. You have Bhutto in there.
Yes.
And I kept thinking, now this is incredible because it ties in that whole genocidal, that whole war crime of the firebombing of Tokyo, the nuclear attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And so I was curious about that because you're tying all those things together in the same thread.
Yes, yes. I thought the Bhutto was very important. The reason Bhutto, which is a very sort of slow, exaggerated movement, Japanese dance, what I wanted to do is the play starts with a scene of a soldier dying to Bhutto dance, and it takes about 10 minutes. And what I wanted to do was to focus on the dying aspect of war, because I think when people go far away, and if you know, you don't have a son or a relative, you're very away away from the idea of the actual dying. And with wars becoming more and more sterile and clinical with all the drones, I just wanted to really bring back that aspect of dying. And I thought Bhutto and the soldier, just us watching, being forced to watch the dying on stage for a long time, but in a very spectacular, beautiful way where you can actually take it in as an audience and not turn away, just to bring that a little closer to us, the dying that happens. Because I feel that that's a very big part of what we're missing here, that these kids go off and they, you know, we see them come back in body bags and we miss what's kind of gone on in between, intentionally so or not. You know, that's what happens.
Yeah. And again, you, like I said, you've done this work on your own very powerfully, actually. What is it that made you want to focus on Howard?
Well, I was living in Boston and I met him and I met Noam Chomsky. And I think what made me focus on Howard was that I was really not able to understand what was going on in the news in America. It was just bullet point, news flash, entertainment. And I remember I was playing with different forms of theater and I wanted to play with interview theater. So I was going to bring these interviews on stage. And when I met Howard, I said to him, gosh, you know, news has become like entertainment. Why don't we make entertainment into news? And he laughed and he said, he shook my hand and he said, let's do it. And that was it. That I would have a hard time with all the jargon that's used just to understand what was going on when I came to this country. And it was when after I read Howard's books, and he had such a facility with language, with talking to the everyday person, and really cutting through the jargon and really letting you see the clear picture. And after I read those books and I talked to him and I said, oh, okay, I get it. I now understand what's going on. I'm not crazy. I'm able to understand that, yes, we're lied to. Yes, you know, the what's good for the government isn't necessarily always good for the people. And I quote Howard when I'm saying that, that sometimes the two have different goals and different intents. And it used to drive me crazy because I think that can't be right. But yeah, it is right. And I thank Howard. And I really wanted to sort of pay homage and respect to him for bringing that to me. Because growing up as a kid, I used to hate history. I used to think, why does one, you know, why does one need to study history? It's in the past. And it was my most hated subject. And it's just so funny how the karmic wheel turns around. And here I am actually doing a play about history.
My most hated subject was religion.
Okay. Oh, well, is it still that?
Yeah, sort of. Anyway, listen, one other question, because I think it's really, it's remarkable just how this play has developed. I remember when we first met, we were having lunch and you told me about this play that you were working on, and it sounded really exciting then, and you finished it now and you're taking it to a major
theater festival.
Yes,
yes, yes. We're very excited. We actually are going to be premiering this production at the Edinburgh Theater Festival this summer. I don't know if you know about that festival. It's the largest theater festival in the world. So it'll get great exposure. And we think that's a great place to open it. So it'll be playing throughout the whole month of August at the Gilded Balloon, which is one of the main venues in Edinburgh. So we're very excited to be doing this. And I'm very happy to have the help of Howard's daughter, Myla Kabat-Zinn, on board. She's helping us a great deal, as are some Hollywood people that are coming on board now to support us. So we're very pleased. You can find out a lot more about my play on my website. And it's just my name, biancabagatorian.com. There's a link to the Howard's Inn play, and you can go there and sort of read all our progress and find out more about it. But yes, we're going to start rehearsals in July in New York and then be off to spend the month in Edinburgh. So
all right.
It'll be nice to see how the Europeans react to this play. So
can you hide me in a suitcase and bring me with you?
Absolutely. Come right along.
Okay. All right. And when you come back from this festival, it will eventually be staged in many places throughout the country.
Yes, we have a lot of interest from theaters around the country, in Boston, in New York, in Chicago, in L.A. So, yes, hopefully it will be playing at many theaters, The Time of Our Lies. And you can find out more on my website. And we'll be probably showing some excerpts on my website from the Edinburgh production, too. So I just think that it's the most valuable thing I can do for Howard is be a conduit for his words now that he's gone. And in his own words, every small act counts. And I hope that this is my small act of bringing his words to the people.
And he's got a hell of a conduit here. All right, Bianca.
Thank you so much,
Thank
Michael,
you, Bianca,
for having me.
Yeah, sure. Anytime. When I see the play, you'll come back and we'll talk about
it
in greater depth. You've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. All right. Well, that just about brings us to the end of yet another show. Wow, just goes really fast, especially when you got a show like we had today. But before we go out, There's something I wanted to read to you from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And it's something, actually something that is thematically runs all the way through the show today in different ways. All right. So here's this from Bob Avakian. First, people don't make choices in a vacuum. They do it in the context of the social relations they're enmeshed in and the options they have within those relations, which are not of their own choosing. They confront those relations. They don't choose them. Two, if people feel for whatever reasons that they want to choose to harm themselves and others, we're going to struggle with them, but we're not going to blame them. We're going to show them the source of all this in the system and call on them to struggle against that system and transform themselves in the process. Just because a youth chooses to sell drugs or a woman chooses to commodify herself sexually doesn't mean that they chose to have those choices. And there is no other way besides fighting the power and transforming the people for revolution that all this will change for the better. Blaming the masses for bad choices just reinforces the conditions that they're oppressed by. In sum, people do make choices, but they make them enmeshed and confined within the social relations that are not of their choosing. We have to bring into being different social relations and conditions so that masses of people can act differently and relate differently to each other. Fundamentally, that takes a revolution, which is aiming for communism. And again, that's from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. You want to check out more about this? You can look at his book, Basics. You can pick up an e-copy. Go to revcom.us, revcom.us, all right? You can find out all you need to know and more by visiting that website. So now it's time to move into the closing for real. I want to thank all of my guests today, Professor Jody Armour, Wayne Kramer, and Bianca Bagatorian. I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, and my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson. I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And if you want to follow us on Facebook and Twitter, do it. But please do it in a cool way. Not in a way that freaks me out because I scare easily, okay? So we're going to go out now with one more cut from Wayne Kramer's new album, Lexington. And it's Wayne Kramer, and the band that he's performing with is the Lexington Arts Ensemble. And this piece is called Taking the Cure. Talk to you again next week.